All right, so this is a bit of an unusual start to the podcast, Chris, but I wondered if you could come and sit down next to me over here. There's something I needed to have a chat with you about.
This sounds serious.
Yeah, well, I don't really know how to break this to you, but I've been unfaithful to you. I've been having meaningful conversations with another man, with men, actually, and with other women. These conversations, they don't reduce the love for our conversations, but I just have so much desire for intellectual stimulation that I can't be limited to just you.
Right, well, I'm glad you finally told me about. How long has this been going on for, Nick?
It's actually been going on for since before I met you, Chris.
Goodness. Well, I'm not sure what sort of judgment should lie in store for this unfaithfulness.
I'm sure we'll find out later in the conversation.
Later in what conversation?
This conversation we're about to have, Chris. I'm sorry to spring this on you, but I thought we might you might be willing to try a threesome tonight, possibly.
As in, okay, so we have a guest on the podcast. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
Yeah, I can give that a go.
That's good, because we've got a few good ones lined up in the near future.
Is this a good one too?
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a crackerjack. This one's so good that it's where I came from.
Where you came from.
Yeah. So I thought I'd invite my dad along tonight.
Oh, right. I was thinking geographically, but yeah, okay.
I guess it's closer geographically than where you are, but that's not what I was meaning, no.
Yeah, we haven't done the proper intro yet.
No, do the proper intro. Do.
Take it away, God.
Hello, this is God speaking.
Can we dial that down?
Yes, my lord.
Thanks.
Welcome, new arrival to the Eternity Ward. Please take a number and make your way down to the left or the right to the waiting room. All you need is the refreshments I made just for you. I would tell you to steer clear of the apples, they're forbidden, and the two snakes. I mean, fools, sorry, that are chewing the fat in the corner, but you probably wouldn't listen anyway. So good luck, I bless you, and on your way.
Welcome to the Eternity Ward, where we sit around waiting for an appointment with God, and I guess we sit here and look awkwardly at the dad that's just come and sat down next to us for a conversation. I'm Chris Adams.
I'm Nick McKinnon, and we've got a guest.
Yeah.
This fella here, actually, Chris, can I introduce the reason why I wanted to get this lovely young man on?
No.
Bad luck.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
I've been a bit frustrated with you, Chris.
Well, you know. Goes both ways.
Good. So whenever we talk about the Bible, you're far too eager to just throw it under the bus, and especially the Old Testament. You just throw it out. Who cares about that thing? And I want a Christian on this podcast that's going to stand up for what is right. This man here tonight, Chris, he's a man that's been a Baptist pastor for decades. He's helped start Christian magazines, local community poverty relief organizations, homeless drop-in centers, refugee and asylum seeker support marches, community carols events, helped dozens of other churches find decent pastors, which is no mean feat, helped hundreds of pastors cope with difficult churches. He's run an interdenominational retreat and training center, plus, most importantly, had three wonderful children and a 40-year marriage to my mother. So Jeff McKinnon is our guest tonight. Jeff, did I miss anything? What did I miss?
You overstated most things.
Excellent.
Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We've got someone with credentials.
He's actually read the Bible, unlike you, Chris.
Finally, someone with credentials. That's really cool. So decades, you've been a Baptist minister.
Yep.
What's the actual title that we should be calling you by?
I usually use the word pastor.
Yeah, pastor.
It's Reverend. Reverend McKinnon. The very reverend.
I am a reverend, but I don't use that title. I don't believe in it.
I feel like it'd be fun if we called him Reverend McKinnon for the rest of the podcast, Chris.
I like it. I guess we should start asking you some questions. So we've just got an outline of your works and achievements over the past decades, including children. But where did it all start for you, this whole journey with faith? Were you brought up as a Christian yourself, Jeff?
No, I wasn't.
Right.
I grew up in a family that really didn't have any church connections much at all, and I came to faith when I was 18. by a chance meeting with a young woman at a coffee shop. Got talking about Jesus. She got talking to me about Jesus. And God did a work on me. Yeah.
So were you interested in the topic of the conversation or may there have been another motive for that conversation?
Both are true. There was a motivation that she was a young lady my own age. I was 18. Also, I liked trying to win an argument, and she was arguing that I needed God and that I was a sinner and I needed Jesus' death on the cross for me, and I thought I could out-argue that any day.
You didn't.
Yeah, you lost.
I lost it with myself, with God, walking home. Yeah.
So you won the argument with her.
Yep, yep.
But God then stepped in to say, no, no, no.
He called me a hypocrite.
So that was a turning point in your life, 18 years of age.
Yeah, that's right.
Before that, what, you'd not had much to do with this whole religion stuff at all? Or?
Yeah, very minimal. I kind of never had major doubts about Christianity. That was all that you knew about in those days.
Mm.
But I had no real relevance to my life, and yeah, I had no real connection to church as much at all. Went to some scripture classes at school and stuff like that.
How do you get to be a pastor of a church? You know, 18 years of age is when you come across all of this stuff. I mean, I feel like for most people that end up, you know, being like a pastor or a reverend, that they have been brought up in it. They've decided that this is what they want to do with their life. It's almost like they're trained from birth to be in that sort of fold. Like, how do you get to be so learned on everything to be able to have that sort of a senior role within a church?
I was totally ignorant when I started out. I knew zip. The very first conversation I ever had about the Bible was when I heard two people discussing translations, and I didn't realize they were talking about translations. I thought they were debating which was the better Bible, this one or that one. And so I was really confused, and I spoke to the leader of the group afterwards and said, you know, can you actually choose which Bible you want to believe in? And so he explained that to me. I started right from square one. And even when I hit theological college about 5 years later, maybe 4 to 5 years later, although I'd read through a fair bit of the Bible, I really didn't remember a lot of it because I hadn't had Sunday school lessons. And so remembering some of the characters in the Old Testament and stuff, all of a sudden you're studying it at a theological level, and everyone around me sort of had done that stuff in Sunday school, you know. So I just had very, very little of it.
You know, Nick and I both grew up in Christian households, so we came with all of the jargon. You know, there's a lot of words and ideas and I guess sort of like culture and stuff that is understood that you pick up, but you had to start from zip.
Yeah.
So can you imagine how your life would have been different if you had have grown up in a Christian household?
It's really hard to, because I don't know what that would be like. One of my problems being a Christian father is I'd never seen it before. So I don't know. You can tell me, but I think I raised you reasonably radically by most Christian standards in terms of encouraging my sons to think for themselves. I don't think I ever gave you this is the position you're meant to hold on anything. I told you what I thought the Bible said, but I encouraged all three of you to have your own minds and your own reflections and work it out for yourself.
Friends of mine are shocked that you guys let me watch like South Park and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and all these other shows, or The Simpsons. Some people weren't allowed to watch The Simpsons, which baffles me.
Did you watch all those shows, did you? Why wasn't I told?
Absentee father. Too many prayer meetings. Yeah. Wasn't at home looking after his kid. Yeah.
Praying against The Simpsons, I was.
No, Chris is a Simpsons fan.
Eat my shorts. So you went from having this moment when you're 18 years of age. Mm. God calls you a hypocrite and you find it hard to ignore him, and you start this journey. At what point did you decide that throwing yourself, the whole of your being into it, you know, this is now going to be what you do with your life? Where did that come from?
I had a terrible relationship with my father and my mother to a degree. And when I got baptized, they kicked me out of home. So I went and lived with a group of guys at the entrance on the central coast of New South Wales, and we considered it a Christian community, although it really wasn't that. It was six blokes living in a house disgustingly together. But we had a grand notion of what it was. And so that was where I first started to become aware that even within weeks of being a Christian, God started to use me as a Bible teacher because we'd share devotions, we'd, you know, take it in turns, and sometimes God used me to say things that proved to be quite out there and changed people's thinking and so on. And for me, it was just reading the Bible and saying what was bleeding obvious, you know. So that was happening. And so really I went off to teachers' college. I became a leader on the campus of a Christian group, and a whole heap of things happened there. I started teaching after I was trained as a teacher and just knew I wasn't doing what I was meant to be doing, even though I enjoyed teaching. Cut a long story short, I became a pastor.
All right. My experience with pastors is, you know, being up the front, you know, within a church and having to pastorally care for everyone and deliver sermons and everything, that everyone has the opinion that they've got it all together and they're very certain in their belief. But I think the more I've been reading about pastors is they're often the ones that can run into doubt more than anyone else, but they feel like they can't share that. So I don't know, you've had this massive turnaround at 18, you've had these experiences and, you know, of sharing with other people that have started to shape who you are. Did you run into doubt at certain points in your journey?
I think everyone has doubts. Some people deny them rather than face them, but I think we all have them. And I think doubt is a part of faith. So I don't see that as that it's not an opposite thing. It's a part of working through how life is. Mm-hmm. But for me, not so much doubts, but if you're seriously growing in your reflections on the Bible and on God and life and discipleship, what it means to follow Jesus, you're going to be asking some pretty hard questions at times. And it's not so much about doubt. It's more about, are you willing to explore the outer edges of those possibilities of those questions? And I think that's where I've gone a fair bit. And you don't always want to say some of that stuff in church on a Sunday morning.
You can say some of those things here, because I think that's why we got you on, because we wanted to have a look at some of the hairy, scary questions around the Old Testament, specifically, you know, a lot of people's view that the Old Testament has a lot of violence and that God is perceived as very violent within the Old Testament.
Yep.
And you're the one with the credentials.
And not only the one with the credentials, like over the last, I don't know how many months, but the last bunch of months, you've actually been doing some personal research into this sort of topic of how to make sense of those parts of the Old Testament which don't really square with Jesus's message. Is that right? Or yep. How would you phrase what you've been up to?
Yeah, that's exactly it. What do you do with that stuff, and what are the different ways people have handled it? Trying to grapple with some of the best ways of handling it, I guess. Yeah, because the reality is there's a lot of profoundly disturbing parts of the Old Testament, and so it's really a question of what you do with that.
Cool.
Okay, so yeah, so I'll just say that some of the folk that you've been listening to, Nick, you know, the Richard Dawkins and the Christopher Hitchens and so on, they...
My reverends.
Yes, I've seen some quotes from them saying that, you know, the God of the Old Testament is a vindictive, bloodthirsty, ethnic cleanser, an indiscriminate massacre. He should be facing charges of crimes against humanity. These are the sorts of accusations that get thrown at the God of the Old Testament or at the Bible. Generally, how would you, you know, respond to some of that stuff, Jeff? Reverend Jeff?
Well, that's one response, and I think there's others. But certainly the beginning point for me is to acknowledge that those bits do exist in the Old Testament. So there's a whole lot of parts. There's the genocide narratives, which are talking about going and killing every man, woman and child and so on. And sometimes those passages are actually using the language of worship in that. So it's an act of worship to God to do that. There's a Hebrew word, harem, that's used for total destruction of people, kind of like as an offering to God. You know, you're massacring them and giving that slaughter to God. So that language is used a number of times in the Old Testament. There are statements about God being violent or commanding extreme violence. There's even a metaphor of sexual assault as part of that. There's laws about capital punishment for moral failure, even many cases of that being to do with children. There's also some statements which are, I don't think are as much of a problem, but they're the ones that people often quote. For example, Psalm 137, verses 8 and 9, which Psalm 137 is a psalm of deep pain and grief for the Israelites when they've been taken into exile. And it finishes with a very violent statement about wouldn't it be good if someone came and smashed their kids' heads against rocks and stuff, talking about the enemy. So that passage has less of an issue for me in that it's actually more about a statement of how deep grief we sometimes feel. I think there are situations where all of us sometimes have less than pure desires about some horrible people who do horrible, horrible things. If you're on the receiving end of that and your family's been on the receiving end of that, you might make a statement. And I think in some ways it's actually kind of a good thing in a way that the Bible makes some of those very deep human statements of grief and pain and vindictiveness, really. So I have less of a problem with that one. But there's over 1,000 passages or verses in the Old Testament about God being violent, so there's plenty of others to pick from.
Yeah. I guess one thing I want to ask is, so are those passages mostly about God being violent or people being violent, people saying that God's being violent? You know, like how do we know that God's the violent one from these passages? Like, do you read the stories of that if God says, go and kill these Canaanites or whatever, is your understanding is God saying that, or is that a bunch of people saying, this is what God said? If they're reporting that this is what God said, do you take that as, yeah, okay, that's what God said, and then you try and figure out what that all means? Is that how you see it? Or because a lot of what I do is, you know, I go, the Bible is written by people about their journey, what they think their relationship with God is, what they think might be attributable to God, but it's not necessarily literal for me. You know, it's not necessarily that this is what God is doing, but this is what they're saying God is doing. So I don't know, how do you stand with that?
Yeah, I think I'm largely in line with what you're saying. I have a real problem with people who just want to minimize the reality of violence in the Old Testament or who ignore it. I think a lot of Christians just ignore it, or they kind of apply it to their own private lives in some, you know, I have battles in my life or something. So I think you've got to face it front on, really take seriously the detail of what the passage actually just said.
So what's the problem with if someone's ignoring it, why do you take issue with that?
I don't think it's treating the Bible seriously enough. I think it's there, and so therefore you've got to say, okay, well, what do I do with that? And I think morally I can't just pretend it's not there. I can't minimise it. I've got to address that and say, what do we do with that? And so you can take the Dawkins and the Hitchens sort of position of saying, well, that just proves that if there is a God, he's a terrible monster. Mm. And I think liberal Christians have tended to take the view that as they face that stuff really front on, they've tended to minimise their belief in the validity of the Old Testament. They have a low view of the Old Testament. Whereas I think Jesus has a different position, and that's my reference point, that Jesus says two things. There's one passage in Matthew 5:17 where he's speaking specifically about how he handles the Old Testament. And he says, I haven't come to abolish it, but I've come to fulfill it. And then he goes on, if you read the rest of that chapter 5, 6 times he says, you've heard it said, but I say unto you. And often he's just quoting straight out of the Old Testament, this is what it says. And I'm now saying something different.
How do you make sense of that? Like, how do you say that Jesus said, you know, I'm coming to fulfill it, I'm not coming to overturn it, but then he says the exact opposite?
That's what you mean by the word.
How is that fulfilling it?
It depends what you mean by the word fulfilling.
This is the thing, because I am one of those liberal Christians. And so, you know, fulfilling it, you know, like as he's on the cross, one thing is, you know, it is finished, you know. So things like that, that's part of fulfilling it for me, is that it's finished.
I think Jesus was clearly bringing an ethic of love, of radical love and of grace, forgiveness. His ethic of love confronts parts of the Old Testament which are violent and vindictive, and are in full agreement with other parts of the Old Testament, which were saying the things he said. In fact, he often quotes the Old Testament. So love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind and strength. Love your neighbour as yourself. They're both quotes out of the Old Testament. His very teaching is coming from bits of the Old Testament, but he's actually deliberately, I think, doing, I could show you examples of this, where he is deliberately and consciously, and the Apostle Paul does it too, are deliberately and consciously quoting bits of the Old Testament that they then turn on their heads. In a sense, say the opposite of what they're actually saying. Mm. And they're saying, okay, this is here. We're not pretending it's not there, but that's not how God functions. God has always been a God of love and of radical love, of sacrificial service type love. bits of the Old Testament that don't say that are missing the point.
Right.
This is a little bit off topic, at least it might be. But so if you're saying that Jesus was coming to say it's all about love, essentially, what do you think about the idea that we just get rid of, instead of calling yourself a Christian, throw away Christianity, because like you don't interpret it this way, but there are plenty of people that could justifiably read those parts of the Old Testament and take them to mean what they literally say and say that, you know, God says to kill non-believers and God says to kill whoever it is that particular verse says. Like, what about if you just, instead of worrying about the term Christian, just say, look, I'm all about love. Love is the thing that drives me. It's the thing that gets me up in the morning. And that's my religion is love.
I would have personally have a problem with that. For me, my religion, I don't like that word, but my religion is got to be all about Jesus, not about love. And Jesus then points me to love. But because your definition then of love becomes the issue. And every culture and every generation has its own definition of love. For example, before Augustine in the 500s, love was always a public, demonstrable thing. Augustine was the one who made it a personal, private emotion and sentiment, which gives excuse for violence. You can love someone whilst also pressing the button that destroys half a city. Whereas I think the earliest Christians who were closer to Jesus just would never have got that. They would just say, that's just stupid. That's not the way of Jesus. And so for me, I get what you're saying about that, and I tend to call myself a follower of Jesus more than a Christian for some of those reasons. But for me personally, the focus has to be Jesus rather than any value or ethic or other thing you want to hang your hat on.
So on an individual level, for me personally, who grew up in a Christian household, who... like, I think my interpretation of love is pretty similar to what Jesus lived out. And so if I, when I think to myself, when I hang my identity on love, I am hanging my identity on essentially the values that Jesus taught. And so it might work for me personally, but you're saying that it might not work on a society-wide level where different cultures have different interpretations of love.
Yeah, and maybe in the long run it doesn't make that big a difference. I don't know. I'm not God, so I can't really... say.
You heard it here first, people.
But I do think it's important for me at least to be following Jesus, because I think that's what he wants of us. It comes down to whether you have an agnostic view of God in the world or not. And so I want to personalize it in a person, because I think we live in a world of persons and relationships.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of elements and levels and dimensions of what we're talking about if you take away a personal being at the center of the universe. So for me, Jesus is the ultimate reflection of who God is, the ultimate revelation of who God is.
Yeah, and it seems like it's also the filter through one way of reading the Old Testament. So you wouldn't approach the Old Testament without having that filter first, which makes it interesting when it comes to Judaism then, because they don't have that filter. But so you were talking about...
I could say some stuff about that if you want to.
Yeah, sure.
Actually, in the Old Testament, there are at least two streams of thought. There's more than that, but even if you keep it simple, there's, if you look at Jesus with the Pharisees, he's debating love over law keeping. They're wanting to keep the law, like say the Sabbath. He heals on the Sabbath, and they're saying, but you can't break the Sabbath. And he says, but this guy needs help. Mm. And what better day to do it than now when he needs it?
Mm.
But Jesus seemed actually at times to actually deliberately set it up to happen on the Sabbath. He went looking for the opportunity to have this head-on collision with them. And he did that a number of times. So it was really about he's wanting to bring up the issue of love versus law-keeping, is my phrase. And those two themes are in the Old Testament right through. The law-keeping is the major voice, but the minority voice is kind of a questioning of that and almost a protest of that. And Jesus is saying, that's the side I choose. And most Jewish theologians... a reputation would talk about those two voices. So Judaism has always been a religion of debate and of different perspectives, and there's diversity, probing, questioning. Jewish theologians often talk about the fact that the Old Testament doesn't just give you, in a sense, God's view on things. It gives a human reflection on that. Like, look at the book of Job, you know, Job and his friends. You got every point of view you'd want to there, you know. And that's true in lots of bits of the Old Testament. It's the nature of how the Bible is. It's a different sort of book to what we imagine it should be.
Did you know that Job was your son's favorite book from the Bible when he was growing up? Not necessarily now, but was at the time, because Job argued with God.
Mm.
Were you aware of that?
I might have been the one who told him that Job argued a lot. It's good to have contentions with God. That's the word I like out of Job.
Yeah.
To say, God, I don't understand why you can do that or why you said that. You're God, I'm not, but I don't get it.
Yeah. Let's get back to some of that contention. And you were saying that Jesus was siding with a different sort of perspective. So is the Old Testament representation of God wrong? Or is there more to the story in the sense that there is all of this violence in there, but maybe there's this moral which says, look, there's all of this violence, but this violence isn't working, you know, and Jesus was able to sort of like draw that out. I don't know. The big question is the Old Testament representation of God false?
I think there are some lots of individual statements in the Old Testament which are false, the statements about God. But many of those same passages, I think there's a thing called progressive revelation going on where people had a limited understanding and that grew over time. So lots of the passages in the Old Testament where there's violence, they actually talk of two ways that violence is happening in the same passage. They'll say that God wiped out these people, but then later on they'll say, but King so-and-so actually wiped them out. You know, so there's a human agent and there's a statement that God did it as well. And in the ancient world, you got to think what the ancient Near Eastern culture was like. It was pretty universal right across the ancient world that people had a very simplistic view of how gods did stuff. Of course, they're all polytheistic. There are many gods in each of the cultures. So Judaism was the first monotheistic culture where they said there's actually only one God. And so in the ancient world with lots of gods, you had some gods that were good and some gods that were bad and some gods that weren't particularly this or that. And there's a whole mixture of personalities. Now, all of a sudden, all of that stuff's got to happen by the one God. And so that's basically what the Jews, some of them sometimes said. They said, God caused that to happen or God said to do this. And the other thing that's going on too is that in the ancient world, and you see this today in some parts of the world, to be a king, you had to be very, very strong. You had to glorify violence, really. You weren't going to stay on the throne if you weren't violent. So it's a bit like with the dynasty in North Korea at the moment. You know, the first thing you do when you get into power, you kill all your relatives off because one of them is going to try and take over. They did that a lot in the Old Testament times in the whole wider world. And gods had to be seen as very powerful. So many of those statements about saying God did terrible things from an ancient Near Eastern ears, that's a statement of how wonderful God is. That, wow, you've got a great God. Your God does even more than what my God does, you know.
But, like, to me, that just makes God sound like a human creation. Like, we make him to be the ultimate king instead of, like, if he actually existed, like, he wouldn't let himself be represented that way in his holy book.
Yeah. And one of the key issues, Nick, is that you just said then how God lets himself be represented. And right through into the New Testament, on the cross, for example, God consistently lets himself be seen in a way that's really, really easy to take the wrong way. And the New Testament says explicitly that the cross is foolishness. The cross is weakness in the eyes of many people. It's a really bad strategy if you want to win lots of people into thinking you're a cool God. So the very way that the ethic of love takes Jesus, and I don't see the cross as being a violent thing where God was punishing Jesus, that violent sort of atonement theory, but it's more about God expressing his love for us and sacrificially.
I'm glad you never expressed your love for me like that.
There was no Abraham and Isaac moment.
We thought about it often.
That's an interesting story that I've heard, like you were talking about a progressive theology. Is that what you said? Or a progressive
revelation?
Revelation. That's the words you said. Because I always hated that story of Abraham and Isaac. Just loathed the story. And then I heard from another pastor. He's quite famous. Mr. Rob Bell explained the story in a slightly different way. So, you know, the story is about what sort of a God would allow or ask for a father to sacrifice his son.
Mm.
So he goes on to talk about, I mean, there's a lot to the story. I don't want to get into all of it, but he goes on to talk about it's a progressive revelation in that the answer is not this God. And so in their time, in their world with all of the other gods that you were talking about, human sacrifice was normal. It was, if God was angry, things weren't going well in the fields or whatever, you would take the thing that was most precious to you and you would sacrifice that. So it was normal. And so the story here is meant to be a story that speaks to the people of the time. They've heard this story before. God's angry. You have to go and sacrifice the son. Suddenly there's this plot twist and they are all like, oh, what's going on? You know, God shows up and says, no. So a lot of us see the story, he says we see it in the wrong way, that it's not actually a story about what Abraham is going to do for God, but it's a story about what God does for Abraham. Mm. And so God's giving, God provides the sacrifice, and there's more violence. There's a lot of animal sacrifice stuff. There's a lot of stuff about blood throughout the whole thing. That was a story that I loathed and finally found a way to go, okay, so maybe that isn't something that I should just discard anymore, that story. Maybe there's more to it that I'm not seeing. So I'm wondering if there's more to a whole lot of other stories, you know, like there's the story of Noah. I mean, this is God wiping out everybody, every living thing that walks the earth, you know. He's looking down and he doesn't like what he sees and he decides to wipe the whole lot out. So how do I...
And animals, not just people.
Yeah.
I'm going to wipe all the animals out too.
So where's the progressive revelation within that story?
That's a very ancient story, like even more ancient than Abraham. So therefore it's further back in the progressive revelation link. I don't think there's a saving twist in all, a lot of these stories like there is in the Abraham and Isaac one. I don't think there is a saving twist that says, oh, that explains, that helps. There's not there. There's a lot of things you could say. Water is a major symbol in the ancient world, particularly in Hebrew thinking, of chaos. It's in the creation stories, it's in the flood stories, in the Red Sea and so on. You can just keep going into the time of Jesus, storms on the Sea of Galilee and so on. They were desert people, so oceans and seas and so on were pretty scary places. So the single worst place for something to happen would be to have a flood that flooded the whole world. It's a story of absolute fear and so on. And it's very much connected to chaos, the idea of the powers of darkness that God is fighting. So without going into detail, I think that's some of what's going on in that story back in its cultural context.
I was just going to say, is saying at the end of that whole story that I will not do this ever again, is that a progressive revelation?
You can be the judge of that.
Yeah, I'm going to kill all my kids except for one and then say to that one that I don't kill, I won't do it again.
The Bible is both the words of people and the words of God, and how that mixes is tricky.
Can you explain to me in that story which part is the bit that God was telling? Because I can understand all of it if it's just people telling stories.
Well, I think it could be true in the sense that God is grieving deeply over the brokenness of the world, in a sense throws his hands up in the air and says, what do you do with this? You know, it's because in the context of Genesis, Adam and Eve sinned. It was personal sin where they walked away from God. Then it's Cain and Abel, so it's become relational where brother kills brother. Then it becomes societal. So at the beginning of Genesis 6, it says that the whole of society has been infected by selfishness and violence and so on, and then God says he's going to do what he does. I'm not justifying or defending the violence attributed to God in that, but what I'm pointing out is that God created the world to be a good place and there's brokenness in it now and he's reacting to it. So certainly that's revealed to how God thinks. The other bit that I'd say is the story of the rainbow at the end of the flood story, the rainbow is a warrior's bow. Of a bow and arrow. God's kind of saying, I'm hanging up my bow. Now, I don't think God ever had a bow and arrow that he, you know, I don't think God was ever a violent God, but at least in progressive revelation, someone started to see maybe God's not going to be violent from now on.
So
that's the best I can do with it.
So in terms of progressive revelation, we're lucky in this conversation in that all three of us accept the science behind evolution and the idea that, you know, the universe was created 14 billion years ago and our planet was created 4 billion years ago. And so humans have been around for something like 250,000 years or 200,000 years, somewhere in that ballpark. So are you saying that it took God, I don't know, 248,000 years or 198,000 years to get the message across to humans that it's not okay to kill your kids if they swear at you, or it's not okay to kill all non-believers.
Yeah, I think those things you're saying there were those laws in Leviticus and so on about killing your kids. They were standard everyday views of everyone in every religion of the time, pretty much. I think the Old Testament, in a way, is a mixture of God communicating with people, but they're mixing it up with their own stuff and not hearing it clearly, and it takes time for it to be sifted. And you see that in the biblical stories. Like, one of the great benefits, Chris, of not going to Sunday school was that you don't have a Sunday school view of the Old Testament. I've only ever read it as an adult. So King David was a violent warrior. He wasn't this nice Sunday school kid who killed a giant and then, you know, did some nice things. He was extolled for killing tens of thousands of people when Saul had only killed thousands. Think about that for a minute, you know. Like, but in ancient language, that's exactly how people thought of kings. They wanted their king to be ruthless. They wanted him to be a destroyer. That actually is a statement that this guy is a great king. And it's not our idea of greatness, but it was theirs. And David had household idols. He jumped out the window, I think, from memory, and when people were coming to get him and they found there was an idol in the bed sheets that made it look like he was in the bed. And where did he get that from, you know, hanging around his house? There's just lots and lots and lots of examples like that in the stories that these guys didn't have God fully worked out at all. They had very limited understanding.
So if the Bible is this story of humans getting closer and closer to the proper interpretation of God,
yep.
Does God share any blame in that misinterpretation? Like, if you and I are having a conversation and you're just hearing the wrong thing over and over and over again for 150,000 years, surely I share some blame in not communicating effectively.
I'll let you be the judge of that. I think the other thing to say, though, is there are these minority voices all the way through the Old Testament. They're there again and again and again and many, 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 many times.
Yeah, but they're humans. What about God? Why isn't God making it more obvious to everyone?
They're in the Bible, though. They're statements in the Bible just as much as the other ones are. So all I'm saying...
Yeah, but like you said, they're a minority voice.
Yeah, they are. There's a dialogue going on. Actually, I think it's to do with power. The majority voice is the most powerful one in Israel. And it's to do with the temple, which is exactly why Jesus had a problem with the people who were running the temple in Jerusalem. He headed straight to Jerusalem, he headed straight to the temple, and he took them on because that's where power was held in Israel. And a wrong understanding of God will always prevail where people have power, where power is centralized and held tightly. My understanding is Jesus was having to go there. Now, what you do with that in the Old Testament, you know, I don't know, but I think there's a place for there being a minority voice, a voice crying in the wilderness that's saying, but this is true. And for some reason, it's a really interesting question to ponder. If there's a God, why would he allow himself to be positioned like that? And I'd suggest to you the cross is exactly the same. Why does God allow himself to be seen in a bad light? Why doesn't he make it really, really plain? I think it's a bit the same with Jesus' language. You read Jesus' language in the Gospels, he talks a lot about being a king, about the kingdom of God, and that immediately most people take the wrong way. I think Jesus has almost, in a sense, got his tongue in his cheek, except it's really, really, really serious. He knows people are going to misunderstand what he means by it because our understanding of power is the exact opposite of God's. So when we talk about Jesus being Lord or God being a king or any of that language, we immediately are thinking the exact opposite of what Jesus means by it. And yet he lets us do it. I can't explain that. I'm just pointing it out to you.
So it's amazing to me that both of you guys think that these answers, this progressive revelation, this idea that God's true meaning of the Bible is actually the minority view, the minority voice in his own holy text.
In the Old Testament.
That's a more in the Old Testament.
Yep.
So that's more plausible than that these maybe are just the ramblings of ancient barbaric cavemen. Like, isn't that a possibility?
Yeah, could be either. But I just found it interesting listening to Jeff talk about power and all of that because I've been reading a book by John Safran at the moment, and he talks a lot about structural violence and non-structural violence. Structural violence being there's an institution, I guess, that holds power and they're not meeting the needs of people, or they're oppressing people, and that's a form of structural violence.
Yep.
And whereas non-structural violence is just, you know, people fighting, I guess. Generally what we see is, you know, people having a fight. But the structural violence is the major issue. And so we've got these minority voices going up against this structural violence. We've got Jesus going up against what's happening in the temple. But if we're talking about power, I'm also going, well, who's more powerful than God? So the violence that comes from God, if there is any such thing, is that a form of structural violence? Is that something that we should fear? Well, I mean, we had a question from a listener, Lou, who was asking about the concept of fearing God, you know, that's all in the Bible, and and being a God-fearing person. And but there's also the stuff in there about do not be afraid and do not fear.
I think the idea of God being king or lord has more to do with the powers of darkness than it does with us. The picture in the Bible is of a spiritual battle going on, and I think the lordship of Jesus is more to do with him defeating powers of anti-creation, powers that take away life, take away love, take away beauty, joy, and so on, and of restoring his creation. So the kind of Lord that Jesus is, paradoxically, is a servant. That's what Philippians 2 says, and the story of Jesus says that. So Jesus never, ever, and God the Father never, ever act violently or with misusing power or, you know, structural violence or anything like that. The very nature of who they are is to be a servant, and they've lived in eternity in that loving, serving relationship for all eternity. So that's my understanding of what the Bible is teaching. A really interesting bit of the New Testament is the Apostle Paul. I think Paul is often really badly treated by a lot of people these days. People think he hated women and all sorts of stuff. And I think that's just because we don't read him correctly. We read him with 21st century eyes, someone in the first century. A lot of his conversion was actually a conversion away from violence. You think about it. Before he was a Christian, he was a good Jew. He knew his Bible well. He'd been trained under the greatest Bible teacher of the day, Gamaliel. He knew his Old Testament back to front, and he was going around persecuting Christians. He was going around finding the minority groups and taking them out. You know, he wasn't killing them most of the time, although Stephen got stoned, but he was arresting them, putting them in jail, getting them into strife. You know, so he was actively violent. And somehow meeting Jesus and meeting Christian people in that story of on the Damascus Road, somehow he goes from that to being quite anti-violence. You read Romans chapter 12, and every one of Paul's letters has long slabs in it about love and about the place of love in the Christian life. In the early part of the book of Romans, there's a long section which is talking about evil in the world, and he quotes four times, he quotes the Psalms. In all four cases, he leaves a bit out of each of the Psalms, which is really violent, and he turns those Psalms on their head to say the opposite. So he's saying this is a sign of how bad people are. But back in the psalm, it was saying this is what we want to do because we're God's people. And Jesus did that too in Luke chapter 4. I just think that happens again and again, that these guys were reading the Bible, but they're now reading it through a grid of love, and that changed the way they understood the Old Testament. But they understood that there was dialogue going on in the Old Testament, that there was more than one voice. There was a debate going on in the Old Testament. That's how the Old Testament is written. And Jewish people have always been structured their theology around debate. They love fighting and arguing over things, you know. That's a Jewish thing to do. There's always more than one opinion. It's basically the Jewish idea, you know. You've never got the final view on God. It's basically their view. And I think they're right.
So the dialogue you're talking about is between, what, the institution and the minority, or between the spiritual battle, which, or is it both?
It's both, because the human powers, and this is an interesting thing for me as a pastor to say, and someone who is in leadership, which isn't a bad thing to have that, but the moment we have human authority, there is the danger that we fall into the wrong kind of leadership, that we move out of servant leadership and sacrificial leadership and into self-serving and a gaining of more power and, you know, the stuff that empires do. And it's about fear too. But at the back of people are these powers of darkness which kind of brood over humanity. So when Jesus went to the cross, when Judas came and kissed him, Jesus actually looked at the temple authorities and the elders and the people who came to arrest him with Judas, He looked at them and said, "Your hour has come, darkness is reigning." That was his statement to them. He's talking to human beings, but he's saying behind your actions, there is darkness reigning. And I believe what God is doing is, and this is true in some of those Old Testament stories where God actually just allows evil to feed itself. I think evil has a kind of a built-in self-destructiveness in it. It's very similar to that phrase that is attributed to Martin Luther King, that the universe has a long arc toward justice. I forget how it's said exactly, but, you know, that idea that life tends to go towards justice. Similarly, you can say the same in reverse, that evil kind of defeats itself eventually. It overplays itself, and in the long run, it kills itself. And the powers of darkness thought they'd beaten Jesus, and it looked like a loss for all intents and purposes. He was dead, put in a tomb, but it proves it the other way around, and the powers of darkness were both embarrassed and disempowered. So that's my understanding of what's going on, and I think one of the single hardest things is I believe in a God who doesn't believe in PR, who doesn't believe in dressing himself up nicely, who doesn't mind if for 2,000 years people think he did the Bible really badly. He doesn't mind if people think that the cross is foolishness or that the cross is weakness. He kind of just takes that on the chin. That's kind of okay by him, you know. I don't know fully why, because he doesn't tell me.
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting things I've taken from this. But there's some things that I struggle with, which is, you know, when you're talking about the forces of darkness and when you're talking about God looking down on a broken world, and, you know, I struggle to understand, you know, if a creator makes human beings and then it's all broken, but the creator is outside of time, then, you know, how did God miss that was going to happen? So for me, it's sort of like, was there a fall? Is there such a thing as a fall? Is there a broken world? Is there evil? Because part of the problem with evil is I think that we can often use that as a cop-out instead of, you know, it's, oh, it was the devil made me do it. So I don't like a lot of that stuff. And, you know, if we're then talking about the forces of darkness, then this is not where we're really wanting to go. But, you know, then it brings up the issue of hell. And I have issues with, you know, if we want to talk about a God of violence, then what is a God that's going to judge humanity and send them to hell for all eternity? That's the most horrific, violent thing that I can possibly imagine.
Yep.
Yeah, anything you want to say in relation to that?
I think any subject in the Bible where it is being described by Christians as being a violent thing like hell has to be open for discussion. The atonement is the other big obvious one. So the way often we describe Jesus' death on the cross wrongly, in my view, is that, you know, I sinned, Jesus is paying the penalty for my sins, he bears the wrath of God for me, and God is angry and he punishes Jesus and he thumps Jesus and he whips him and he kills him, and it's a very violent picture of what God is doing to his son. I think that is wrong. I that's not what's being said, I don't think. Similarly with hell, my personal view is that there probably is a place where God is not. That the whole idea of heaven and hell is heaven is where God fully is and hell is where God isn't. C.S. Lewis suggested the idea that if God is victorious, as the Bible consistently says he is, on the cross, then the idea that only a small fraction of humanity go to heaven and the vast majority of people go to hell doesn't sound very victorious. It sounds like you've lost pretty big time. Because I have to look at the Bible through the lens of the cross and Jesus' non-violence, I have to look for alternatives as to how I understand it. And then when you do that, you start to notice things. So you notice that Jesus rarely ever spoke about hell except when he was talking to the Pharisees. And then you start to notice what Greek word he uses for hell, because there are different words. Our English translation may actually not be the right translation of what Jesus was talking about. I don't want to throw away the validity and the value of Scripture. I have a very high view of the Bible. Getting back to what you're saying about the powers of darkness and how that can be an excuse not to take responsibility. See, the Old Testament has some wonderful passages that make your point exactly. So even though the Bible teaches the idea that there are these dark powers, it's not saying that means I don't take responsibility. When Jesus made that statement about darkness reigns, you know, in this hour as they're arresting him, he was talking to human beings and he was saying, you guys are responsible for your actions here. He was sheeting home to them personal responsibility, but he was also talking about the powers of darkness. He was doing both. I think both go on all the time.
So where did these powers of darkness come from? If God created everything.
Yep, they're part of the creation, yep.
So God created them.
The Bible doesn't really say. There's Christian traditions about it, as you would probably know, about Satan falling and taking a third of the angels. That might be true, but it's based on very thin information. I don't think the Bible gives us any answer to that.
So do you have a way to think about it that helps put your mind at ease?
About how it started or?
Yeah, about why it exists in the world. Because it doesn't make sense to me that, like, unless God isn't all-knowing, if he didn't know what was going to happen when he created stuff, like, if that's true, then, yeah, fair enough. If he didn't know what was going to happen when he created Satan and didn't know that what was going to happen, that he was going to become this evil bastard, well, fair enough. But if he did know that and he still chose to create him, I've got some problems with that.
I think the other bit to that is whether God's all-powerful and I...
But he had the power to create.
Yes, yes, he did.
And if he's all-knowing, like if he's outside of time, like you talk about him as being,
yep.
Then he knew what was going to happen the moment he chose to, unless he didn't have a choice in creation, because that's another thing that like Einstein's talked about, that God, maybe God didn't have a choice in creation, that he had no option.
How do you know the mind of God? I don't know.
Yeah, I know, but like, but how do you think about it that puts your mind at ease? When I think about those questions, I just go off. The only thing I can think of is that either God's a bastard or he doesn't exist.
But I don't think that's the only option. I think because God is a God of love, he wants to give us the potential to make decisions. I think every parent, you know that with your kids, you raise your kids and you know that they're going to make some bad decisions. You know that because you did. You made bad decisions before them. And so you know that, but you still let them do it.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah. You let them grow up and you let them make their own mistakes and that's really painful. And some of those bad decisions in some extreme cases are extremely serious. You know, they're not just a two-year-old having a screaming fit. It's, you know, people kill people or do terrible, terrible things.
Yeah, but the difference between God and me is that I don't have a choice in something. So I can choose to have a kid, but I don't have a choice whether or not there's a snake in the garden who's going to lead my kids astray. If I had that choice, then I would choose not to have the snake in the garden to lead my kids astray. I'd just create the kids. Whereas God had the choice and he deliberately decided to choose to have evil in the world.
He made his creatures, including the angels, personalities. He made people. And people have the capacity to do good and evil. And that was built into the structure, rightly or wrongly. You can have an opinion on that, although I'm not sure you're in the best position to make that judgment compared to God. But that's, you know, that's how it is. I just think the Christian explanation for good and evil is far more eloquent and elegant than an agnostic position or a naturalist position, because I don't think the naturalist position has any explanation for goodness and beauty and wonder and all the things that matter most in life. You don't really need almost anything other than a grey old world to evolutionarily evolve.
But you need to have a reason to want to stay alive, and so beauty is part of that. I want to stay alive. I want to pass on my genes because this world is beautiful, because it has beauty.
Things could have evolved to not need beauty to enjoy life.
Well, things could have evolved not even to have consciousness. There's no reason that we need consciousness to survive. There's plenty of things that survive that we wouldn't think of as having consciousness, and they do quite fine. So, yeah, that's definitely true. But I think beauty makes sense.
I don't think it does. I think God is the best explanation for beauty. I don't think rationalists really want to face it hard on. God made the world for us to enjoy. And I think one of the great skills of life is learning to be attentive to the wonder and also to the pain. They're both there and they're both there in equal measure, you know. Being attentive to the wonder and being attentive to the pain is what being truly human is all about. And I think that's very much to do with the character of God.
So God is essentially human?
He's person and we are people. We were made in his image, not him in ours.
Yeah, created in his image. So we're, you know, creative, productive, loving, etc. It's just, I remember Father Bob talking on how we often see God as transcendent and powerful and above in the clouds, and where the Jesus story talks into being more human and on our plane. But on power, I thought you, Jeff, were about to say something earlier in relation to God being all powerful or not so. Is that the case?
Yeah. I think if you take the love ethic, if you think it through and you apply it to the character of God, a lot of our understandings of God come out of Greek thinking, the mixture of Platonic thought with the Gospels. And, of course, you can find verses in the Bible that say various things, and so then people quote that and say, there you go, the Bible says da-da-da-da-da. You know, the question of does God ever change and the question of is God all-powerful are two very interesting questions. And I think there's a sense in which God does change and there's a sense in which he doesn't change. I think kind of both are true, and I don't know how to put that together. It's easy to find stories in the Old Testament, for example, where it shows that God changed. God changed his mind. It says God repented on one occasion, you know. I also believe that God was always a non-violent God, right through the Old Testament stories. It's just the lack of clarity of revelation.
Yeah, because that's interesting because, I mean, you're saying that God's a non-violent God all throughout that, and you were saying before that you hold the Bible in very high regards, but you also said earlier that there's some, you know, falsehood, so there's some problems with it. So my question is, you know, why shouldn't I just discard it? You know, how does the Old Testament serve Christianity and serve the world if there are, you know, so many problems, even problems with interpreting it? How does it serve?
The Old Testament does a lot of things that are wonderful for us to know about. I reckon our generation, the postmodern world, is incredibly arrogant. We kind of see ourselves as standing on the top of a hill. We've got all the technology. We've got all the science. We've got what everyone said before us, and we've worked it all out. And we've got some questions, and there's a kind of a humility playing itself in there as well. You know, we play cool, you know, that we don't know everything and so on. But we think that those people in the ancient world were pretty stupid, really. They're pretty dumb. They're idiots, yeah. You know.
Nick's nodding his head, and I was just about to say, we're not arrogant, you know. And yep.
I'm not arrogant, but I'm definitely more morally advanced than the people that wrote the Old Testament.
That's where evolution on its own takes you. It gets out of biology and into social evolution, and I think that's very dangerous. That led to Hitler, by the way.
Who was a Christian?
No, he wasn't. He used Christianity. He used
religion. So on the belt buckle of every Nazi soldier, it said, God is with us, or something like that.
Yep. And on the American dollar.
The Catholic Church was, same with the Americans.
Yep, that's right. Yep. Empires love to use religion. They do.
So if empires love to use it, and there's a lot of that empire and structural violence throughout the Old Testament, again, back to the question, how does the Old Testament still serve us?
When it's so easy to misinterpret.
And what I was going to say is that our generation can be very arrogant about other cultures and other times. When we read the Old Testament, notice how people function, we realize how easy it is to get into wrong ways, and we're just the same. So, for example, I mentioned before Psalm 137, that where it mentions about, you know, I hope they smash their kids' heads against rocks and stuff. That's a psalm about deep grief and pain. And I don't think people in the 21st century are any different. If we face really deep grief and pain, if we have people come and oppress us and kill our families and do stuff to us, we'll tend to become very violent too. I think there's a window on our souls in a lot of the parts of the Bible like that, because it doesn't water down the reality of how human beings are. I think we do well to hear that and work out, what's that say about me? Where are the violent bits in me? How do I find myself reacting when I hear the name Donald Trump? Do I wish I had a submachine gun? You know, I got to admit, I have violent reactions in me sometimes to things. I don't act on them, but in the right situation, if I was provoked enough, maybe I would. I don't know. I hope I wouldn't. We kind of armchair critics sitting in our comfort in the Western world and moralising on stuff. And I think the Old Testament is a lot more raw and earthy and good in some ways.
See, it's impressive to me that you can take a verse that says, happy is the one who seizes your infants and dashes them against the rocks.
Mm.
And turn that into some positive moral ethic about how we should live our lives. Like, if you can do that with that verse, it doesn't matter what's in the Bible. It could be the most horrendous thing that anyone could write, and you're turning it into some positive thing. The Bible is beside the point. It could be anything written there, and you would turn it into some story of love.
Now, be careful. I'm not minimizing what it says. Verses 8 and 9 of Psalm 137 are terrible. They're awful. What I am saying is that maybe I can be terrible. Maybe I can be awful. As Solzhenitsyn said, the line between good and evil in the world isn't out there between nations or wherever. It goes right through the middle of me.
Yeah, but so it doesn't matter whether you're reading the Bible. You could be reading any text and there'll be good parts in it and there'll be evil parts in it. And so long as you're only picking up the good parts in it, well, then it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but Nick, the Psalms are poems written in deep times, in the case of Psalm 137, and it's one person's reflections. Now, God chooses to include that in what we think of as his revelation, and that's an interesting question. But that psalm is not saying that God says any of those things. It's a sad, grieving, aching poem or song. And it's at the end of that that he says with vindictiveness, may these Babylonians who have done this to me, may their kids get smashed against the rocks. You know, it's a statement of strong vengeance.
That has no place in a moral society.
Yeah, but it's not saying it's a good thing. It wasn't saying that.
So why include it?
Because it's acknowledging human reality, that that's part of who we are, right?
Don't you think that sometimes rock songs should address the darker side of life, the pain of life?
Yeah, of course they should.
Is that wrong?
The difference between a rock song is no one is going to a Britney Spears concert and thinking that they're hearing the words of God. That's the difference. Like if everyone was just reading the Bible as though it's some Shakespeare play, I would have no problem whatsoever. Brilliant, go for it. There is beautiful stuff in it. Like I do find there to be a lot of beautiful literature in there that has awesome stories in it with beautiful morals in it and uses some ugly stuff in there to make a good point. But when you start saying that it's God that is telling Joshua to go and murder every living thing in a village, not just people, but every living thing in a village, I don't know. Like the only thing I can do to that is saying, even if that God exists, I will not follow that God.
See, you've jumped from Psalm 137 to the book of Joshua, and I agree with you that the genocide passages are terrible, and I'm not defending them or wanting to minimize the reality of them. They are what they are. And I think Jesus, he never directly says this, but I think what Jesus in effect is saying is that is not how God is.
A lot of people will look at that stuff and think that's what God is, even within the Christian family. And it can be a worry with, you know, how they use, how they see it. But how would things be different if believers understood it the way that you understand it?
Well, my understanding is that there's a trajectory going on in the Bible with this idea of progressive revelation. And so even in the New Testament, there are statements about slavery or about women, for example, which are quite revolutionary statements for their time, but we've actually got to push them beyond the statements that are there to develop the ethic of love. And so I think we've moved a long way beyond, say, with slavery, because slavery was just a universal institution in the ancient world. And so now we would clearly speak out against slavery. Not that it's gone away in the world, but we'd speak out against it. And similarly with the role, the place of women in society. The New Testament's amazingly revolutionary on its view of women, but it still didn't go as far as it needed to go. And so I think there's kind of a trajectory that we need to notice, and it's our role to keep moving that trajectory forward.
So if the Bible doesn't hold, didn't go far enough in relation to that, why is it a closed book? Why wasn't it a growing book? Why couldn't it have been continually added to as history kept happening and as we progressed? So I'm getting from that statement that you think that there's a lot of truth about humanity and about society and the way we interact each other with each other that we don't just get straight from the Bible, you know, that we can figure out outside of that book.
Mm.
It's also going to the question of, like, do you believe that the Bible was the inspired word of God or was written by people or is the word of God? Like the way you were talking about it then was making me, you know, think of, oh, so exactly, you know, how do you see that it was put together? And that's one of the issues I have with it is a lot of people sort of end up worshipping the Bible, and I see that as sort of like an idolatry thing to do.
Yep.
Is it the word of God? Is it the word of people?
I think it's both.
Right.
And lots of scholars say that. It's not just me. I think it's the words of people. I also think it's the word of God. I think God is speaking to humanity through it, but he doesn't speak through it the way I would imagine God should do it and the way I think most of us think. If God was like me, he'd send down an encyclopedia or a dictionary, you know, it'd be alphabetical order, you look up a chapter on sin, you look up a chapter on environmental care and stuff, and it'll all be there, you know, and it'll be the final word on it. God's not doing that. What he's doing is telling a story that's all culturally and historically set in place. That's how God chooses to do it. And I think that says something profoundly about his personhood, that God is a person. He's not a set of ideals or a philosophy or a, you know, he's a person. He relates to people and he relates to humans in their real situations. And in one sense, the Bible isn't finished. The book of Acts, chapter 28, is a really interesting ending to the book of Acts. It kind of implies that it's not finished. The book of Acts tells the story of the church going from Jerusalem to Rome, but it said at the beginning that the gospel is going to go out to the whole world. It's almost like there's got to be a chapter 29, and that's being written by people today. It's still going on. I have a kind of a sense of that with the Bible, but in terms of what God has chosen to give me to have in front of me to reflect upon my life, I have the 66 books of the Bible that are there, but I've got to understand them in their context, in their culture, what's going on in that world, and then we've got to translate that into our world. And it's not a matter of a one-to-one correlation. You find a verse says X, Y, Z and say, okay, we've got to do X, Y, Z. And it's about living out the ethic of love and grace and forgiveness and so on, and doing that radically. And that will be different in every generation. And we can learn a lot from the sciences, you know, the psychology, you know, sociology, and the hard sciences. You know,
Blasphemy.
Is it? For me, personally, the core thing is that Jesus is my focus. Where Augustine got it wrong is he and the medieval church deliberately mixed Platonic thought with Plato's thinking with the gospel. I don't have any problem with using the best of science and the best of philosophy, but don't pretend they can just get mixed in, because that's actually syncretism. That's mixing of worldviews and mixing of religions. You can take the best out of situations, but Jesus has to remain my focus.
And if there's disagreement between your faith and scientific fact, you would go with scientific fact?
That's a very hard question to answer, Nick. Like, you can give a simplistic answer to that, but the reality is, what are the scientific facts? Like, Albert Einstein said things that people don't agree with just in the last 100 years. Quantum physics is challenging a whole lot of the thinking of relativity. Did inflation happen before or after the Big Bang? You know, like, there's so many things that we don't know about, and yet people have dogmatic views on, but there's other people who have a different dogmatic view, and they've both got the scientific facts. In one sense, that sounds clear and easy, but I just don't know that it's quite that simple. Like, please don't hear me. I'm not saying that I think the world was created 4,000 years ago and evolution didn't happen, but I don't think we know a lot of things about the stuff we talk about. In a generation's time, a lot of the stuff that we thought was just really obvious about cosmology will probably be codswallop. So which scientific facts are you going to promise me will still be around in 1,000 years' time?
Gravity.
You just said a word, but, you know, what is gravity? As you know, we now know that it's a warp in the space-time continuum rather than the attraction of a big object from a small object. So the Newtonian understanding of gravity is completely false at one level. It worked in his world, but it actually isn't the ultimate answer. It's actually not actually true. Gravity isn't what Newton thought it was. That's just the reality of science. It just keeps moving on. And it's gone such a fast route in the last 100 years, and it seems to be getting faster. I think science is exactly the same as belief in Jesus. You've got a reality.
Is that syncretism? I wanted to use this new word.
Yeah, it's a cool word. No, I don't think it is, but I do think that both have a reality out there, and we're trying to perceive that reality. And I study the Bible like Brian Cox studies the stars, but I have to admit I don't know it all. There's lots of bits that are confusing and troubling to me, and I hear Brian Cox and scientists say the same thing, and I think that's a good thing.
The idea that science and religion are the same thing is ludicrous. So with science, you start off saying, I don't know what the answer is going to be. In religion, you're starting off saying, I know what the answer is. It's God exists and Jesus is the Son of God. And we'll play around with stuff after that, but I'm not going to debate those two things there. It's completely different. You do not start off with a set of assumptions at the start with science.
Can I just go back to that? You said that, you know, Jesus is the Son of God and we don't play around with that. Let's play around with it. Like, what does it mean to call the second person of the Trinity a son? Firstly, that's masculine. There's a whole lot of conversation we can have around that.
Yeah, but you're debating the words around it. You're not debating the actual idea that Jesus wasn't God. Do you ever have doubts that maybe Jesus isn't God?
No, I don't. And I don't have any doubt about gravity either.
But you can test that. You can't test the Jesus thing. I can pick up this, let it go, and it will fall every single time. I can do it a million times and it will happen. That is proof. It's evidence. You don't get that with religion. There's no way to test whether Jesus is the Son of God.
Nick, what's a proof of?
Gravity.
Yeah, but what, you're just using a word, but what is it?
Okay, well, it's proof that there is a force that acts on this piece of paper and on the earth, and they pull each other together, and it happens every single time. It's repeatable. We can make predictions about it.
And you took care to say that in a different way to how Newton said it.
Yeah, because we've learned since Newton.
Yeah, okay, and that's my point about saying Jesus is the Son of God. Exactly the same point is that you're saying it's just words, but you're just using words too. All I'm saying is that the idea of Jesus being the Son of God, of course, is foundational and true.
No, it's not.
Hang on. But it may not be the first thing that comes into my mind when I say those words. And as it turns out, Newton did a huge number of experiments and proved that the way he was thinking about things was probably right. And it was for, 300 years or 200 years, however long it was, until Einstein started to basically use mathematics based on his observations of relativity and started saying, hang on, that's not probably what's going on. That's a complete revolutionary change to our understanding of gravity. And I think there's the opportunity for human beings to think about things that we take for granted as statements out of the Bible, but to rethink what they might mean, because they are always statements in a context. They have to be. Newton was a man of his time. The Apostle Paul was a man of his time. And we are people of our time.
And God's got new PR, apparently. His name's Jeff.
I'm just telling you what I think.
I found it really interesting talking about just the idea that you think it's profound that God allows a misrepresentation.
Mm.
So I just want to take it back because I felt like we were turning into a different podcast.
We were, yeah.
Let's go with science. But so, yeah, I guess I'd just like to explore that. How is it profound? And you might have said a bit about it earlier, but how is it profound that God, Jesus, you know, even on the cross, allows this misunderstanding, this misrepresentation to occur, that God doesn't control the data that's being, you know, given to us and doesn't give us an encyclopedia. So what do you find profound about that?
It says a whole lot about how we function in the world today. We live in a world where we're very scripted, and we want to present ourselves in the media, and politicians they've got their sound bites and they're trying to control things so that they come across in certain ways and win arguments and all that. And the Bible says that Jesus emptied himself in Philippians chapter 2, that he gave up worrying about being God and being seen to be God, and that's the very nature of God, is not to be self-absorbed, I guess. So I think non-violent love will always be open to really unfair interpretation, whereas the powerful people, the beautiful people, the people with the capacity to present themselves well can hide from, even though they might be sometimes doing terrible things, they can actually appear very wonderful. There's something in that space about, do I choose to live my life with an image, or do I choose to live my life self-abandoningly loving and choosing to go the way of love?
Hmm. You talked earlier about that non-violent love being a, you know, a revolutionary thing in this whole, you know, progressive revelation, being revolutionary. You even talked about Jesus, you know, going against the law, you know, like on the Sabbath and stuff. And I think I want to say, I have seen your social media posts of you being rebellious and going against the law with the Love Makes a Way campaign. And, you know, I don't mean to be rude, but you're a bit older than I am. So I'm like going, I hope I'm doing the sort of stuff that you're doing at your age. And I want to thank you for coming on and chatting to us. about all of this stuff, Jeff.
It's been a pleasure.
Reverend Jeff.
Yeah, Reverend. Yep, that's me.
If you want to hear more of Jeff, go along to City Baptist Church in Launceston every Sunday morning. You'll get to hear plenty more of his pearls of wisdom.
You coming, Nick?
I'll drop my kids off anytime.
That's cool.
Cool. Are your sermons online, Jeff?
Yes, they are, I think. Yep.
Brilliant. If you're wanting to hear more of that and you're not in the vicinity of Launceston, you can go to City Baptist Church. Must have a website. I'm sure if you Google that, you'll come up with whatever it is that needs coming up with.
Yep.
Cool.
So, thanks for coming on, Jeff.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening and joining us here on the Eternity Ward. So, cheerio from me.
Farewell from me.
And even from me.
Scott here again. If at any point in this podcast you found yourself yelling vainly into the void at two idiots who can't even hear you and refuse to listen to you, then congratulations, you know exactly how I feel. Luckily for you, there are other ways to contribute. You can leave reviews on iTunes or wherever you listen to it, share it on social media, or discuss it in your blog, podcast, or fellowship group. Subscribe, like, nod your head, raise your fist, shout amen, but probably don't send a prayer because I'm kind of busy right now. Join the discussion in the comment sections, ask questions, and do come back and join us again here on the Eternity Ward.